Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
I love that little intro. That's from Kevin MacLeod, a guy who does some music on the internet that he allows people to use for free. Good stuff. Thank you, Mr. MacLeod. Anyway, this is Alejandro Rojas with UFO Think Tank, and we're here for yet another wonderful show. We've got Franklin Carter on the show tonight. This is a gentleman who was a Navy radar technician back in the day during the Cold War, watching our backs, looking out for the Soviets to cross the dew line and get us. But thankfully, Franklin was there with his brand new radar technology to keep them at bay. However, when their brand new radar technology went online, they got some weird things happening high above the sky, and he's going to tell us about those strange things. In fact, those strange things and him talking about them actually got him to be one of the Disclosure Project witnesses. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Disclosure Project. This was something put together by MD Dr. Stephen Greer back in 2000, where he brought a bunch of people to the Washington Press Club. And you can go to disclosureproject.org and see a lot of these videos, and you can actually see in the extended version of the interviews, you'll see Franklin Carter. And he was going to be there at the Washington Press Club, but he didn't make it. So we'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about some more personal experiences he had after that. And then going beyond, he has been involved in this field for decades ever since. He helped Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who I've had on the show before, with his Wyoming UFO conferences. And he also is now very interested in something that we're, the Institute for the Study of Galactic Civilizations. It's something both of us are a part of. And this is actually examining, could extraterrestrials actually have or be talking to human beings here on Earth as we speak or in the recent past? We'll talk about that. You know, if they're flying around, if we're seeing some things flying around and we got the military guys telling us they think they're extraterrestrials and people in the military think they're extraterrestrials, well, maybe somebody's actually talked to one of these pilots, and actually many people say they have. So we'll talk more about that. We'll talk about why Franklin believes that and some of his very interesting concepts. Before that, however, as usual, we'll get into UFOs in the news over the last week, and there has been quite a bit going on as usual, so we got some great stuff. I know last weekend we were talking about the X conference going on and how on Monday they were going to have a press conference and Edgar Mitchell was going to address the press and talk about his belief that extraterrestrials were here and, you know, Roswell really happened. And he certainly did that, and he got some news. He got in CNN did a big write-up on that. I believe the Washington Post did, too, another one. But they did, they covered it very well. They really didn't make fun. They were kind of like, wow, you know, if this guy who walked on the moon says something is going on, should we think about this? And so there are some great stories. So he did a good job speaking again, but this time, like I said, in front of the press in Washington, D.C. Yeah, the Washington Post was the other one. I have both of these links at UFO Think Tank. If you go to ufothinktank.com, you'll be able to see that in the UFO news. You can join the email list. Also, if you go to the Yahoo News Group on the Blog Top main site, you'll be able to see this info as well. Also, you know, we weren't doing a show last weekend because I was at the Starfest doing a sci-fi convention, kind of like the Witch Mountain movie, and that was a lot of fun. And hopefully we have some new listeners from that show. Thank you guys for joining. It's always wonderful because we get a lot of people who have had their own sightings and experiences, and we get a lot of people to sign up for the email list. So got another 50, 60 people. So that's always a lot of fun. More news. Texas couple captures a V-shaped UFO on camera. So there's some video out there. It's interesting. This comes from the UFO Examiner from examiner.com. He also has a video up there from some people who shot what may be a UFO in Maine. So there's some video out there you can check out. If some of you are video experts, you can see what you see there. Some people think they don't see anything special. Some people say they do. It's always difficult with videos because even if it is great, you know, then you have all the people coming and saying, oh, it's fake, and you have the people who say, I could have faked that if I wanted to. Sure, you know, you could have, but what we're looking for are those things that could possibly be real, especially if you have multiple witnesses. Also on examiner.com, I am the Denver Paranormal Science Examiner, and I, as I told you earlier, went on that cattle mutilation investigation with my good buddy Chuck Zukowski out of Colorado Springs. But I posted, he got from Colorado State University, which is one of the best vet schools in the country, he was able to get them to look at some of the samples of the hide that we took from those animals. So I have the results up there. Essentially, they don't know what happened. And I think that's really cool. They're not saying it was scavengers or not, but the flesh itself, they say, was taken after the animal was dead. And the reason they come to that conclusion is because there wasn't bleeding when these cuts were made. So what killed these animals? It's possible they were poisoned because they certainly do not have any signs of predator damage. There's no blood around like it would usually have when if a predator got to it. They're just kind of dead. And if they were poisoned, you know, by whom and why? And there's no evidence of people being in the area either. So if we were able to get those animals to a vet who could do a necropsy, that's when they cut them open and check everything out, we'd be able to discover what happened there. But we haven't been able to do that. Luckily, by forging these relationships, if something does happen in the future, hopefully we'll be able to get the animals out there and figure that out. But a lot of fun. I'm going to post a story real soon here, too, because the Humane Society also feels that foul play was afoot in these deaths. And they've offered up a reward to find out who is hurting these animals. So I'm going to try to give them a call, see what they have to say, and I'll put that together in a story on theexaminer.com, Paranormal Science Examiner. We talked about this last time, Paranormal Science Examiner, and hopefully you guys took your homework that I gave you to go out and spread the word and for me. Thank you very much for those of you who did. AOL also, I believe as a result of these Edgar Mitchell stories, put up some polls as to, and I'm going to click on this one to read you exactly. It was, do you think extraterrestrial beings have visited Earth? Well, as of the posting, when I sent these out yesterday, 73% of the pollers said yes. And that was 324,000 people. No was 17%, which made up about 74,000 people. Undecided was 10% at 46,000 people. Very interesting, because you're talking over 400,000 people that clicked, you know, gave their opinion on this. That's a lot of people, nearly 500,000 people. The other question that they polled people was, do you think the government is trying to cover up the existence of extraterrestrial life, which essentially is what Edgar Mitchell was telling people? Out of the people polled, yes was 76%. With 326, almost 327,000 voters there. No was 15% at 65,000 people, and undecided was at 9% with 36,000 people. Of course, this isn't a scientific poll where they go out, and actually I'm in a statistics class right now for that sort of thing, and you know, you go out and get a random group of people, and you choose very carefully, and you do all the statistics and stuff. They didn't do that. They just kind of posted this on the website. So still, I think, some very interesting results. More stories as a result of Edgar Mitchell was one from The Telegraph, which is a big paper out in the UK, and we've been talking about the UK and their UFO stories for a year, and they've got a lot going on, of course. And this one was about, are UFO real? Is the question, famous people who believed, and they list a bunch of famous people and their quotes regarding UFOs. They talk about Jimmy Carter, who had his own sighting, General Douglas MacArthur, he was a general during the Korean War and the Second World War. Of course, he was the guy who, you know, started up the communist witch hunts back when, so not the most kind of an infamous type of fella. But he had an interesting quote, if you haven't heard this one. The next war will be an interplanetary war. The nations of Earth must someday make a common front against attack by people from other planets. The politics of the future will be cosmic or interplanetary. Some interesting comments. J. Edgar Hoover, he talked about UFOs. Monsignor Corrado Balducci, the guy who worked at the Vatican, unfortunately he passed away this year, but he was in charge of demonology. He talked about extraterrestrials and saying, oh yeah, they're here, they're definitely around, and they're pretty much our space brothers. Stephen Hawking actually has made a positive pro-UFO comment in the past. He said, of course it's possible that UFOs really do contain aliens, as many people believe, and the government is hushing it up. Interesting, because I've heard lots of negative comments from him. Herman Oberth, a Nazi rocket engineer, if you've heard of Project Paperclip, we brought in a lot of Nazi scientists over here to work on some of our stuff, and he says it's his thesis that flying saucers are real and that they are spaceships from another solar system. There's no doubt in my mind that these objects are interplanetary craft of some sort, and I and my colleagues are confident that they do not originate in our solar system. I apologize. I don't have a German accent that I can use there. I'm not very good at that one, or I would have. But the section where he says, I and my colleagues are confident, is very interesting because, of course, that shows that he discussed this with some of his colleagues. And, of course, he's a rocket scientist. So there were people talking about it. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, we've talked about him a lot. I'm a big fan of his. He's a hero. Helped Steven Spielberg with the Close Encounter movies. Was in charge of Blue Book and debunking UFOs till he saw enough evidence to convince him there was something going on. Finally, someone from the UK, Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding. He was a commander of the RAF Fighter Command. Talked about how he was convinced that these things aren't created by anything on Earth. Ronald Reagan had his own sighting, and we've got a quote from his sighting. Mikhail Gorbachev, He said the phenomena of UFOs does exist and it must be treated seriously. Richard Nixon said, I'm not at liberty to discuss the government's knowledge of extraterrestrial UFOs at this time. I am still personally being briefed on this subject. How interesting is that quote? In fact, I don't know that I've heard that quote before. And then finally, Walter Rydell, who was another research director of Nazi rockets, and he says he's completely convinced that UFOs had an out-of-world basis. So a great story written by the Telegraph. Finally, Kazakhstan is the first country to build a UFO alien embassy. And how fitting that should be our last story going into ET contact, like Franklin and I are going to talk about in a minute. So they actually, and this is from a Russian paper, and some kind of rumors going on, but I guess they're fairly substantiated, that the country of Kazakhstan is creating an alien embassy. So they really seriously have talked about how UFOs are coming here. You know, we're showing how we are future forward thinkers. We're building this embassy so we can be ready to greet them. They're going to have a landing pad there, and they're going to have people who can translate and a bunch of other things that you would find at an embassy. So they're kind of opening their doors to these guys to say, hello, come on in. So pretty cool. All right, well, there's our news for the week. Without much ado, let's move on, because I believe we do have our guest, Mr. Franklin Carter, on the line. Hello, are you there, Franklin?
Yes, I am, Alejandro. Oh, how are you?
All right. Wonderful. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great, and I'm honored to be on your show. It's a great program, and I'm just really honored to be a part of it tonight.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. I'm honored to have you. So Franklin is a good buddy of mine, and let's get into it. I do want to get into your history first, and we'll kind of move through that to get into some of the stuff I know that we're both interested in now. But this all started for you while you were in the Navy.
Yes, it started in, I went in the Navy in 1955 and became a radar technician. An ET. In fact, I've been an ET since 1956. That's the designation for an electronic technician in the Navy is ET. And so I've been a long-term ET. But my job was to work on and repair and keep running the radar systems on the ships. And when you go through a school and you come out and graduate, then you get a pick in the Navy, or at least you did back then. They give you a list of stations that you can go to. And one of those stations was a radar picket ship, is the way it was listed. And then I asked what it was, and they said, well, it's got, for you, it's got the latest equipment that's owned by the U.S. government. Anywhere in the world, you've got the latest equipment on that ship. So I chose that ship and wound up spending 2 years in the North Atlantic bobbing around like a cork. And that was where I first had an experience and didn't really pay much attention to it. I was in charge of the radars on the ship, and we had three very large systems, and they were manned 24 hours a day. We sat in a little circle between Argentia, Newfoundland, and the Azore Islands. If you look at a globe, that's kind of like a gateway coming into the U.S. from Europe. And we had four ships out there, about 300 miles apart, and we were always on station and picking up and reporting everything that we had radar contact with. And one night I was called to fix the radar, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I went down and I asked them, I said, well, what's wrong with it? And they said, well, we're reporting contact flying 3,400 miles an hour. Now, this would have been in early 1957, sometime in part of 57, could have been the later part of the summer of 57. But so I went, shut all the radar down, started back up, went through all the safety checks and everything, and it was working fine. So I went back and told them it's working fine. I said, how did the contact just before that one do? And they said, well, it was a airliner, and it was doing 300-400 miles an hour and perfectly normal. And I said, well, what are they doing now? And they said, well, we've got another airliner, and says it's running perfectly normal. It's running 300 and something miles an hour, and we've reported it. Everything's on course and everything's fine. But says that was a,
now, was this
a
first,
solid. Pardon?
Was this the first radar of this type? I mean, was this a brand new, like you said, cutting edge technology, just turned on type of thing?
Well, it was had been updated. It was one of the early airborne radars that that you use, and we had a very powerful radar. It had a long range, and I don't know how far out the contact was. We couldn't tell the altitude of it with that particular radar, and the one that did determine altitudes was not working at that time, so and never did work very well. So we didn't get an altitude on it. But you get a course and a speed when we were doing this work. You have from the first time you pick up a contact, and a radar contact, a radar screen looks kind of like a TV screen, and you have a little circular. The antenna is rotating at about 10 times a minute, and there's a line that goes around that indicates where the radar antenna is pointing. And if it sees a contact, you will get a big bright blip in this on that spot. And so if it's a real solid radar contact, it'll be a very solid blip and be a very big blip, be a quarter inch or more. And you can tell, that, you know, in six or seven sweeps, if it goes around and it's there each time, you've got a solid contact. There are times with weather conditions where you can get ghosts, they call them, and they'll be there one time, and then they won't be there again, and you may never see them again, and then they may show up once again 15 minutes or something. But this is a real contact, and it was running. You get a course and a speed from your plot, and you have 2 minutes to report it to NORAD down in Cheyenne Mountain, which they were just starting up, and at this time they had only been in operation a couple, 3 years, and we reported to them by radio, by Morse code. They sent in all the information on those contacts. And that night I asked the operations officer, I said, well, have you reported this contact? And he says, no, I haven't. You just told me there's nothing wrong with the radar. And he says, you know that if we report something going 3,400 miles an hour, they're going to tell us there's something wrong with the radar. And, of course, you've got an hour to tell them what it is. And he says, I don't want to go through all that unless you do. I says, I don't. And he said, well, we're not going to report it. We'll just let it go. And that happened in 57. And during the next 6 or 7 months, we had about six more of those contacts. The very next one, about 3 or 4 weeks later, I was actually on the plot board doing the plotting. And sure enough, it came across and was 3,400 miles an hour. And it was flying from east to west. And there was going right across the top. If we plotted it on out as to where it would have went, it went right across almost between Canada, the U.S. and Canada border. It would have come across when it hit land. It would have been along that lines and went out on the other side. So that was how that was the start of my UFO experiences, and I really didn't pay much attention to it. You'll have to realize I was 19, and we weren't into UFOs, and I was thinking about, you know, I wanted to get it. When you live in the North Atlantic, 30 or 40 foot waves are the constant, and so you're always bobbing around, and I just, you know, just get me back to shore and let me get out and find some good looking girls, you know. That was all I was worried about at 19.
Well, about how many times then during this period of time did you get those hits?
We got about five or six times during that six-month period. And a real interesting thing took place about that same time. If you go back into the history, the Russians had fishing trawlers, and that was what they were supposed to be. We know that they were disguised aircraft, ships that had all kind of electronics equipment aboard them, but they were posing as fishing trawlers. And so they would come around into our area. They would never get real close. I never saw one, but we saw them on the radar, and they would come in within 25 miles of us, just around the horizon. And we begin to get all kinds of radio interference with the frequencies, and of course the frequencies that we were assigned each time we went out We stayed out 30 days, and then we went in for 10 days and stayed out 30 days. And that, every 30-day trip, the captain was received a crystal and a set of instructions, and that was our radio frequency that we reported on. So nobody was supposed to know that. When we left the port, we didn't know what the frequencies would be that we would be reporting on. And here they are jamming. We were getting music and kind of like the Tokyo Rose thing. We were getting this lady that, with a real funny accent playing music and talking about how lonely it is in the North Atlantic and all that kind of stuff. But it was on these frequencies that nobody was supposed to know about. So this was all going on about the same time. And so the Navy sent one of their they call it the Criminal Investigation Division back then. I don't know what they call it today, but it was one of their spooks. And they came and stayed on the ship about it, two of those trips, listening and taping the interference and everything. And they also questioned us a little bit about what we had, the contact, when they found out. Of course, it was rumored there were six guys in the radar, they called it Combat Information Center, and that was where everything took place on a ship. And so that's where this guy hung out, because that's where the radios were and where the radars were. And, of course, all of the people that were – there's 18 that were assigned, so each time there's six on a shift, and we're running three shifts a day. And so the rumors, you know, everybody laughs and talks about this. So he asked about it. Now, I don't know where that was, why he was there, or whether he just picked up as a peripheral thing, but they did it about the same time the CID guy came on and stayed there for – two trips with us, and then we never heard anything else about it.
Well, and then what did they do? Didn't they come up with a solution to your problem?
Oh, well, this was, interestingly enough, I never thought any more about this for years. And then once I began to get involved in the UFO thing and I went to some conferences, I heard another person talk about a 3,400 mile an hour sighting at that same in that same time period, and they had been in the Air Force and were on the Alaskan Dew Line, which was a permanent big radar system that was on land in Alaska to detect, you know, the radar, the guided missiles or planes or anything that would be coming out of Russia from the west. And I did talk to the fella. I called him and spent about an hour with him on the phone, and he said that what happened with them is they had the depth finder. They could tell how far it was out in space and everything, and they were picking up these contacts as much as 600 miles out in space. And he said that the Air Force reported that, and they sent the company that built the equipment came in. They put cameras on the screens and made movies of the radar contacts that they were getting for about a week. And then the next thing they did is they went in and repaired the radar system so they could only see out about 35 or 40 miles into space. they fixed the problem where you no longer reporting those contacts at 600 miles in space. And he said that was the fix they did, was they fixed it. The ones that we had on the ship, they never said anything. As far as I know, I was never talked to, never asked about it formally. I never had a hearing or anything like that. So they just let it go because we never reported them. And the six or seven times that we had them, they were never reported.
And that's funny. And you never reported them because you just didn't want any trouble, huh?
That's right. It would have been something as important as that, and I know that this was true because a couple times we had problems with the radar, and we were 1,400 miles off the coast, and they would send planes out, and they would drop us supplies. I needed special parts for the radar that had gone out, and if they were not on board, if I didn't have them in the stockroom, they flew out a crew and put these things in drums and kicked them out of the plane. They flew down as low as they could and right by the ship and kicked them out. And then we had to put a rescue team over the side in a small boat and go out in that choppy water and rescue that drum and bring it in so I could have parts. So they took it very seriously. This was not a joke. And then one time we had a problem with the antenna and its direction. The motor that determines where you're pointing as far as the compass headings go. And they got shorted out, and they were pointing 180 degrees from where it was supposed to be. And, of course, every contact we had then was an unknown. And, boy, believe me, they sent jets from Massachusetts. They had jets out there within 15 minutes after we reported the first one. And they told us that they couldn't find anything where we said it was. And, of course, when we finally figured it out, the planes, they were on their normal track right where they belonged, but we were reporting them 180 out, and of course, it was kind of embarrassing. I got pretty good chewing out about it, but it was something that there was no way to tell that. There was nothing in the equipment to tell you that short would happen and cause the thing to pick up exactly 180 degrees from where it was supposed to. But I can tell you that the military and the government took this very serious. I mean, we didn't want... just report something 3,400 miles an hour and then have to go through all the hassle of explaining why the radars were okay and that it may have been a real contact. And so we just didn't report it.
Right. So when it was these experiences that had got you involved with the Disclosure Project, how did that happen?
Well, in the process of after I became interested in late 80s, I began to have problems and realized that I had had UFO contact. I got interested in learning everything I could learn, and I heard about Dr. Greer's CSETI, and I joined CSETI, and then in that process, I went down and had one of his ambassador trainings, first one he ever put on, and I went to that and spent 5 days with him. And we talked, and I mentioned that, so when he started up his Disclosure Project, I became one of the witnesses that he came and videotaped. He's got 400 people like me that have had these experiences that were military or government, and he videotaped those people. Now, he says that he's got probably 600 or 800 more, if he had the money to do that, that he would, you know, videotape their testimony, because we're all getting kind of old. he says we need to record this for historical sake. So that's how I got involved with Dr. Greer's Disclosure Project. And I was picked.
Right.
He picked 22 to go to the press club, and I had already had my plane ticket and my motel room and everything. And my mother passed away the day before it happened, and I had to be involved with that, so I didn't go to the press club, but I was one of the 22, so there was 21 of them at the press club.
And people can go to DisclosureProject.org. You can watch the press conference, which is pretty amazing, and then you can also order the videos with the interviews, either the 1 hour or I think, well, the 4 hour, 2 hour and 4 hour is what they are.
And
I'd recommend you get the 4 hour.
that's I don't remember how many people are on that, but there's probably 50 or 60. I know my testimony, I've got about 10 minutes of testimony that I videotaped with Dr. Greer, and that's on there. In fact, that's on some other sites that it's been picked up, and on YouTube a few places you can find it. But that was
got your big old shades on.
This was the testimony I gave Stephen Greer for his Disclosure Project, which was basically what I described to you about the planes and all.
Right. Yeah, so that's some great video that people can go check out. And, you know, you had alluded to, you know, how you really got involved with UFOs was having some nightmares and some experiences of your own. So I wanted to get into that as well.
Well, that's how I really got interested. I began to have what I thought was a really scary dream, but I had it the same identical dream every night for 6 or 7 nights in a row. And so I had a friend that was a dream interpreter, and so I called her and says, I want to come talk to you about this crazy dream I'm having. And she says, well, what about it? And I said, well, I'm having the same identical dream every night. Every detail is clear, and it starts at the same spot. It ends at the same spot. And I says, it's just a very vivid, bright technicolor dream. And I says, I'm just curious about it. And she said, well,
when was this?
That would have been in 88 or 89, somewhere along
the way. Okay, late 80s. Gotcha.
Yeah. And I was going through some personal stress, and things were really stressful for me, and I guess that's when I started having these nightmares, or I thought they were nightmares. And she says, that's flashback. Says, that's your recall from a incident that you've had somewhere in your life. And she says, if you don't mind, tell me what's it about. And I said, well, I'm a little embarrassed to tell you, but it's about a UFO. And she said, well, says, there's a fellow up in Wyoming that does that kind of work. And she gave me Leo Sprinkle's name, and I looked him up, and that's how I got involved with Dr. Sprinkle. I came up and had him go through what was happening to me in that dream. And he regressed me and took me back through that dream, the part of it I didn't remember. And that was how I got involved with Dr. Sprinkle and got interested.
Yeah, do you mind sharing that dream with us?
No, I don't mind. It's I went for a long time and wouldn't tell anybody anything, but I'm totally out now and, of course, you know, giving talks and being open, trying to help people that have had these experiences. And the dream, it started out that I was in I lived in Springfield, Missouri, and there was a big 300-acre field. I was the last house on the end of a street, and it was a big field. And there was a housing project on the other side of the field, and there was an office that for the construction company out in that field. And they had decided to build a house between me and the edge of the field. And so I was no longer the end house, and they had messed up my lawn, and I was walking across in my dream. I was walking across, and the lawn was messed up, and I did go talk to the guy. So that part of the dream was real, and it was a factual event. And I walked across to his office and had some words with him about the fact that he hadn't resodded my soil like he was supposed to and cleaned it up like he was supposed to, and I wanted him to get it done before he left. And as I came back walking across this in the dream, I came walking back across from his office towards my house, and all of a sudden I'm in a little bit of a fog, and then here's this craft, and it's about a 30, 40-foot diameter craft sitting on three tripod legs, and two little guys. There's a kind of a stairway ramp down from the craft. It was probably 6 feet off the ground, and there was these two little guys standing at the end of the stairway, and I looked at him and said, what are you doing here? And they says, we're waiting for you. And I looked up into the craft, and so I said, do you mind if I look in? And they says, no. And this was all telepathic, I guess. I don't remember whether they opened their mouths. I don't remember seeing their mouths opening, but anyway, I had to communicate.
And what did they look like?
It's kind of strange. They were kind of like the Grays, but they had little uniforms on, and they had a little cap on, and their eyes were not as big as the Whitley Strieber Grays. They did have bigger eyes than normal, and they did have a head that was very large for their size. They were about 3 or 3.5 feet high. And at the time, you know, I didn't think to look at their hands and see how many fingers they had or anything like that. I just remember their face. They didn't have lips. They had a little slit, and they had two little holes for noses, and I don't remember seeing any ears. So I walked up this little stairway, and inside there was a console, or kind of a cockpit with two seats in it, and then there was this console of all kind of instruments. Behind those two seats, there was a little bench, and I sat down on this little bench and was looking, trying to figure out what these instruments were when they came in and sat down. And they looked around and said, do you want to go for a ride? Well, I've always been adventuresome, and I thought they were just going to ride me around this 300-acre field, and that would be interesting. And so I says, well, sure. So they closed the ramp, and the dome, when the ramp closed, the dome turned crystal clear. It had been a kind of a grayish dome, like it was painted or something, and all of a sudden it's just crystal clear. You can see the clouds and the sky, and the thing just, there was a slight movement as it took off, and I thought, well, this is not bad, and they're going to move around this thing, bring me back, and sat down, and when I looked up, and we're going up into the clouds, and all of a sudden it's like a bullet, and we went through the clouds and out from a bright blue sky into a jet black sky at, I mean, enormous speed. And this is what would always wake me up. I would wake up screaming no, because I didn't agree to go outside and go up into the space. I just agreed to fly around the field, you know.
Well, I guess it's just a matter of perspective. They're thinking, we're just going to stick to this side of the solar system. What's the big deal?
that's about it. So they took me, and of course, that was all I remembered. I would wake myself up screaming, and this happened six or seven nights in a row, and it was identical every night. And so when I went to Dr. Sprinkle, he regressed me back to that time and to the time that when we broke through the clouds, and took me from there to the rest of the trip. And they took me out into space, and we joined I call it a mothership. It was an enormous globe. I would say it would have had to have been a mile in diameter. And it opened a little portal on the side, and we went in and sat down, and there was a whole bunch of other, there was probably 15 craft like that inside that hangar section. And I was met by, when I got out of the craft, I was met by a guy that looked very human. He was about 6 feet tall, maybe 5'8", 5'9", 6 feet. And he had long white hair with a white beard and was wearing a white robe. And he says, come with me. And they took me into a room and closed the door. It was a small room. And then this greenish-looking gas came out. And they just told me, says, it won't hurt you and it'll decontaminate you. And then I came out of that room after about 5 minutes, and they took me around a corridor that I could see out into space. It was like a glass wall, and then the other side of that wall, there was doors, and then one of those doors was, it opened, and I could see in, and they stopped, and we went in that door and stood there, and it was an auditorium that would seat 300 or 400 people, and they were all, from the backs of their head and everything, it was like a theater. It was like a stadium theater seating, and all I could see is backs of heads, and there was somebody speaking down on the stage in front of them. And this being that had me said, this is where we teach people how to help people back on Earth. And that was all he said, and they didn't leave me there to go hear what was being said with the people that were talking on the stage. I don't know anything about that. And he took me back, and all I remember is we walked around through the ship a little bit, but it was just basically around the hall and then down another hall and back into that hangar. And they put me back on that little disc, and the two guys brought me back and landed me in that field, and I got out. And they took off. And that was that experience. And go ahead.
Was there some missing time?
That was another experience where I had missing time much earlier. I was still in the Navy when I had missing time, and this was conscious. I mean, I remembered that. My buddy and I were hitchhiking home for the weekend, and we weren't doing real well, and we were in North Carolina. Both of us, when I went in the Navy, I was living in North Carolina, and my buddy lived about 100 miles from me. And so we were going to go home for the weekend. And we were about 12 o'clock. We were in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is where Fort Bragg and Pope Air Base is. And I needed to get to the next town, was about 20 miles from there. And so there was a truck driver sitting in this truck stop. We'd stop to get some coffee. And he says, well, I'll take you out part way. He says, I'm going by there, and he says, there's a road out there that goes into the town, and he says, all these people that work at Fort Bragg and Pope Air Force bases, they get off about this time at night, and he says, there'll always be some traffic on that road. It'll take you right into the little town you want to go into. And so we said, fine. So he takes us out there, and it was about 1 or 1:30 by the time we got out there. He put us off in this road, And my friend and I started walking, and we hadn't walked more than a couple hundred yards, maybe 300 yards down the road. And I looked around and saw this big bright light coming, and I thought, this is a trucker. You know, he's going to pick us up. So I'm standing there with my thumb out. And the next thing I remember is my friend and I are rolling in the highway. Of course, we're in our uniform, and we're rolling around on the pavement just laughing like crazy. And we both get up, and, you know, we look at each other and say, what in the world is going on? You know, what are we doing in the middle of the highway rolling around? And we talked about that for a long time on the ship, laughed about it, and said, well, maybe they drugged us or something. You know, we don't know. We can't figure it out. But as we got up and got brushed off, here comes a car, and we thumb, and the guy stops, and we got in the car, and he says, where are you going? And we told him, and he said, well, I'll take you into this next town. And when we had gotten out of the truck, we saw the sign said 14 miles to this town. And I says, how far is it? And he says, oh, it's about 13 and a half miles from here. And we said, God, it's got to be closer now. We've been walking for quite a while. And he says, well, that's how far it is. And so neither one of us had a watch on. We asked him, so what time is it? And he says, it's a quarter of four. And it was 1:30 or 1:15 when we got out of the truck. And now it's a quarter of four, and we had all this missing time. All we had done was we remember walking about 200 or 300 yards. And so that was an incident that took many years. Again, after I had gone to Dr. Sprinkle, he told me that missing time was usually an indication of some kind of contact. I had talked to him about it because I didn't know. And I just remembered it. He asked me to remember all these, anything that looked out of the place now that you didn't think about back then. He says, things that happened to you that were just a little out of the ordinary. They're not necessarily you saw any kind of a UFO or anything. And so I remembered that, and I brought it up. I said, well, I had missing time. And he told me, he said, well, that's a sure thing. It most likely, especially now that you've had these other experiences, it's most likely that was an incident. But I didn't have the money and didn't want, I was tired. We'd gone through about 2 hours of this regression. And, of course, I didn't want to go through any more that day. And so I told him, I said, well, we'll do it at a later date. And I did it with Barbara Lamb at a later date, did go back, and she regressed me back through that incident and what happened to us there when we were in the Navy. And picked us up. What happened is that big bright light was a ship, and it picked us up, my buddy and I. And I remember in the regression, they got us up into the ship, and we, you know, they told us to undress, and we took our clothes off, and there were two big metal tables in the room. It was a round room, and they put my buddy on one table and me on the other table, and I'm laying on my back, and there's nobody around me, and so I'm looking over at his table, and there's three or four little guys working on him, and they bring this tool down out of the ceiling, and it goes in towards the bridge of his nose, and then it retracts, and about that time, this guy in a lab coat walks in that's about normal height, about 5'7", or 5'8", something like that, walks in and comes up to my table and takes my pulse. And I, to this day, I don't know why I didn't look down and see how many fingers he had or what his hands looked like, but I didn't. But I looked at his face, and it was a kind of a strange, it was almost a bug-like face. And I remember asking him, how much more of this have I got to do? And he says, not much. And he walked around the table and looked at me. He never touched me anymore, never did anything else. He just walked around and looked at me and walked out of the room and turned and he started out. He says, y'all get dressed. And, of course, my friend by this time, he's gotten up, and he's a true redneck, and he was just as mad as he could be because they now giving him instructions. He's got to get dressed. They told him to take his clothes off. Now they're telling him to get dressed, and he was really upset about it. And I told him, I remember telling him distinctly, I says, don't worry about it. You'll get used to it. I did. And I thought that was kind of an interesting comment, you know, and right. I must have had a number of these experiences. But we got dressed, and they put this beam, we went down in this beam, and what happened is they misjudged the highway, and the beam ended about 18 inches before it got to the ground, and that when the beam cut off, we fell, and that's how we were rolling in the highway, was because we fell when the beam dropped down, and we were laughing because we were back on Earth, and so
yeah,
I would
happy
assume,
to be.
Yeah, we were happy that nothing went wrong, and
yeah.
He didn't complain of anything. He never complained of having any pain or anything, and I didn't either. Of course, it didn't do anything to me, but he never said anything about that. And, of course, I didn't remember him, you know, with the machine and all that at the time. All I remembered was the blank
right.
time we had. So I don't know, but I remember I went back in my own, just my memories of he and I, that trip and how that trip went. I took him on home and got my car and drove him the 75 miles to his home, and then we came back on Sunday and hitchhiked back to the base and told all our friends about it and laughed about it and how we'd had such a weird time. And that was all that was ever said.
Didn't think too much more. Now, so these creatures on this incident were different than the last one. You had told us about the first one.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. Still little guys, though, huh?
Yeah. They were more of the typical grays, and they were up on the table working on my friend, and of course I guess I was used to it because it didn't bother me, it didn't get scared, and I guess I was used to them telling me what to do because they told me you lay down on the table and be still, and I did, and I guess that was it.
Yeah.
I just turned my head and I could see him and see the table and them working around him, and I saw the instrument come down out of the ceiling, and they moved it around and positioned it right over the bridge of his nose, and then it went back up and didn't make any sounds or anything. And he didn't say anything. He didn't scream or anything, so I don't guess he had any pain. But,
yeah. So, and this was how you got involved with Dr. Leo Sprinkle, and then you really dived into the whole UFO ET field and research and study, right? And started going to
I went big time into the trying to figure out what's going on, because now I realize that this is real. And of course you've read about it, and I had heard about the UFOs back in the 60s. Before 1966, it was common to see newspaper reports that were just factual reports, just like a reporting a car accident. You know, there's a UFO was sighted, or it landed in the road. I remember in North Carolina, one landed in a highway, and I happened to be on that road 2 days later, and they said it had burned, and there was a big circle, about a 15 or 20 foot circle, burned in the asphalt on that highway. And so I thought about it, that was interesting, and I never thought any more about it being, you know, extraterrestrials or anything like that, and just never paid any attention to it, because I was trying to build a career in the pharmaceutical field and in business, and the Navy trained me very well to pay attention to what your assignment is. That's the good part of the Navy training is that, like where I was working down in that kind of the nerve center of the ship, the CIC, you have to pay attention to your job and don't worry about what happens to anybody else. And they tell you, you may be the only guy that survives if it's under attack. So you can't worry about what's happening to everybody else. You stay with your job and don't pay any attention to anything else. And so my wife says I'm real good at that, because I don't pay attention to her a lot of times, because if I'm thinking about something else, that's all I hear. You know, I'm very good at partitioning things. And
from the Navy up until the late 80s, you never gave this stuff much thought.
Not at all. Never read, as far as I know. The only book that I've thought about it a lot recently, because I've been trying to go back through my history, and I have had other incidences I've never talked about that I found that had nothing to do with, one of them had something to do with me, but I was involved in them. When I was about 4 years old, I remember consciously, these are all conscious memories, and my grandmother, I was living with her, and she was a very brave lady, had lived by herself. Her husband had been dead 20 years at that point, I guess, and she was a very tough lady, and I was sitting out in the yard playing in the sand, and I remember looking up and seeing this great big silver-looking thing in the sky, and my grandmother came running out and picked me up and took me in the house. And I remember, I said, "Grandma, what was that?" She says, "It was an airship, son." And that's all she said. Well, an airship, if it had been an airship, she'd have explained it to me, and we'd have looked at it, and she was always explaining things and making sure I was getting an education, you know. So I know now that that was something that scared her, because she grabbed me up and took me in the house. And that was an incident. And then when I was about 10, I was working with my uncle, and he had tobacco, and you have to process the tobacco after it's cured and get it ready to go to market. And we were doing that one Sunday afternoon, and we had a shed that this stuff was stored in, and you go in and work on it and sort it out and kind of grade it yourself. And we had a black lady working with us, a young girl about 18 or 19, and I wasn't paying any attention to their conversation. We were all grading, sorting out the tobacco and putting it into the right kind of containers and stuff. And he said something to her, and she says, "No, I can't do that." Says, "The devil might get me." And he says, "The devil might get you." And she says, "Yeah." Says, "My mama says the devil comes see me." Says, "I got these," says, "these little tiny white guys come in, and they take me out right through the wall." Says, "My mama tells me that's the devil, and I've been doing something bad, so I can't do anything bad." Says, "The devil will come get me." And says, "I don't like it when they come get me." Says, "That's the devil, and I don't want nothing to do with that." Well, I know now that 3-foot little white guys are not the devil, you know. But to her, in South Georgia in 1946 or 47, somewhere along in there, that was the mentality, you know. That they couldn't explain it any other way. It had to be the devil, you know. So.
Right. Wow. So now that you've been reflecting on this, because now you're involved with this stuff, you took over Leo Sprinkle's conferences, and you've been heavily involved in lectures and getting information out. Do you relate, you know, your past and these experiences to what you're doing now?
Well, it made me go in and really think about, and of course, like I tell people in my talk now, I'm a knower, I'm not a believer. Once you've had the experience and come to recognize that it's real, you know then that they're here and that they're real, and that you just as well learn to live with it and try to deal with it. And of course, that's Dr. Sprinkle's business, is to help you learn to live a normal life after you've had that experience. And some people, it really bothers a lot. It never really bothered me. I was just curious. And I had a always been very curious about things, and so I wanted to find out what it was and why I was having that weird dream. And then once he got me onto that, then now I got missing time, and he tells me that's a problem. And then I've come to his conference and started hearing these people tell these stories. And of course, as you know, when we had those closed sessions at the conference where people would get up, we gave them 10 minutes to get up and tell, you know, their experience, and nobody could question them or anything, so that there was a safe place. I mean, there were grown men that were crying, and women that would cry about their families disintegrating. I mean, the wife would leave the man because he was crazy, or the woman would leave the man because he was, man would leave the woman. I gave a talk in Missouri about 4 years ago, and there was a lady on the program there, was 32 years old, and a very smart lady, and she was telling her story that, and was trying to elicit help in understanding this, because she began to have contacts, and they would come and take her out and take her on the ship, and her husband thought she was going crazy. They had two little kids, a little boy and a little girl, 6 and 8 years old, and he filed for divorce and then sued for custody and got custody of the kids because she was having a UFO experience. And the judge said she wasn't a fit mother. Now, this would have been four or five years ago. This would have been 2002, 2003, somewhere along in there. 2003, I guess it was, that I was in Missouri at that conference and gave a talk. And so it does go on, but I never had that kind of, you know. Carolyn, my wife, was very supportive. She's had her own experiences, and so I've never had any problems of not being supportive. I never told my family I'm the oldest of six children, and come to find out, in the last 3 years, I found out that two of my brothers have had experiences or had sightings. They haven't, at least they're not admitting yet that they've been aboard a craft, but they've now admitted they've had sightings. And my mother had a sighting, and my father had a sighting, and neither one of them, my dad, he died right after my mother died, about 3 or 4 months later, but he never mentioned it, but he had mentioned it to my youngest brother, who admitted he had a sighting when he was in high school, and it was we owned a ranch in North Carolina, and my dad was just a cowboy, and my brother told him about the experience that happened to him, you know, the night before. He was up parked with his girlfriend out on the ranch, and this light came down and just scared the death out of him, and it was a bright white light, I mean really bright, and he says Pop told me, he says, that's the same damn thing that happened to me the other day when I was over there checking over them cows, says it come, that was the brightest light I ever saw in my life, shined right down on my pickup, and he says he never said anything else about it. And then I had another brother that lived in Florida that had an experience where he saw this triangle-shaped lights in the sky, and he had somebody with him, and then they were going to meet somebody, and when they got there, there were four or six of those people, and they were all standing there watching those triangles, and all of a sudden they split, and he said they went in three different directions, and he says in the Tampa paper the next day there was this deal about it being a meteorite come through last night. He says it was no meteorite. I says I've never seen a meteorite look like a triangle and then split off into three directions. So
I don't think they do that.
No, so it may be, the reason I relay this to you is there is, and people need to know this, there is a history that is becoming well documented that these things do run in families. So if you're having the experiences, there's a good possibility that if you have children, they could be having the experiences, or if you have brothers and sisters, they could be having the experiences and probably will be reluctant to talk about it, just like I was. Mm-hmm. I never told anybody. And
In my experience, you know, I was skeptical of the whole abduction scenario when I first got involved as an investigator, and I still was when I started to have people coming to me telling me about their experiences. Hearing their experiences, you know, I started to change my mind. And then, you know, I've seen UFOs with a couple of these people. But, yeah, I started to find that there was definitely in every case a connection where a parent or a grandparent and a grandparent typically had some extraordinary experiences along with a child, at least one.
Yeah.
So, definitely a... Mm-hmm.
And that's important for people to know, because as you have these experiences, the first time you have it, I mean, it is eerie. I mean, and to some people, it's very scary. I've never had a negative experience. All my experiences have been positive, and of course, I've had a number of sightings since then, since I got involved and got really paying attention and went through Stephen Greer's training and used to skywatch every night for years. Carolyn and I, we took groups out and did sky watching, and so had a lot of experience and seen a lot of lights and stuff. But I've never had never been afraid. I've never had any kind of fear, nor has Carolyn. And so we've been lucky. We've talked to some people that are very fearful. We knew Leah Haley, who's had extreme negative experiences and abductions and stuff in her life, and we've never had that.
Yeah, thank goodness. And moving on beyond, you know, now you want to move on into a new subject. I'm going to kind of explain what we're doing with the ISGC, the Institute for the Study of Galactic Civilizations. And people can go to galacticcivilizations.org to find out more about this. But going beyond, to start to try to gather information on what we know about these cultures. And my perspective essentially is, you know, there's a lot of people claiming to be getting information from these guys. some of them could be telling the truth. So it's worth getting them all together and hearing what people have to say, I think, because something could be going on here. And I know you feel strongly about this, too.
Yes, that is correct. And there is a tremendous amount, once we got to digging into this, there's a tremendous amount of scientific evidence. That's real hard scientific evidence. There's archaeological evidence. There's all kinds of clues in the anthropology area when you study us and get into the issue of whether or not the Darwin theory of evolution holds up, and it's not a religious thing, it's just the science of it. There's big gaps in the fossil records, and once you look at those mega jumps, you realize that Darwin's story of constant evolution can't happen with these major jumps. And so there's a lot of very smart people that have studied these things, and they've been afraid to say very much. There's some of them have written some books, and I'm finding, much as it was with the sightings and the ET, the spacecraft, the UFO themselves, if you go back into the 60s, you find all kinds of information that before the big 66 when the Condon report came out, and after that the government and the press joined together to debunk and make everybody that had a sighting or anything look like an idiot or, you know, some kind of clown. Before that, the books that were written, and there were a lot of them, I didn't realize that all back in the 50s, there were all kinds of books written, and I'm beginning to find some of those. A lot of them are scientific people that have looked at this stuff. And in fact,
right.
I wanted to add this. I wish I had my book in front of me so I could get the quote exactly right, but we think of Carl Sagan as being very anti-UFO, and when you go back into the 60s, he wrote some books, got involved with a Russian scientist that was the head of one of their space institutes who was a believer. And Carl Sagan, the quote is that there are millions and millions in the universe, there are millions of planets capable of supporting life, and that there are probably hundreds of thousands of planets that are inhabited by beings. And I mean, that's a direct quote out of his book, and I was dumbfounded when I read that. I'd just run across it, but that book was published in 1966, called Intelligent Life in the Universe, and he wrote it, he co-authored it with the Russian. It was really, the start of it was a Russian had written this book, and then somehow, and I don't know the details of how he and Carl Sagan got together, but Sagan then co-authored and added to the book, and they translated it into English, and he added in his little preface, he says, the book is just about twice the size it was when we started. And the Russian had published it in Russian under his own name, and then they came back and expanded on it. But there's a tremendous amount of data in the archaeological world, the fossil world. There's people like Michael Cremo with the Forbidden Archaeology. There's a lot of stuff that had to be man-made or made. It was manufactured. It wasn't. He has evidence of footprints that are dated like 400,000 years ago, and they've been dated and accurately dated. And he's got there's some balls that are round with three grooves around them that they dug out of some of these places. I think that was about 250,000 years ago. Those were dated, and he just has an enormous amount of information. I ran across a Max Flint and an Otto Binder that were both science writers and journalists in the 60s and 70s, and they wrote a book the hypothesis is that humans are a hybrid race, that we could not have been on the evolutionary track and advanced beyond the apes because of the way evolution takes place. And they make the best scientific story I have ever seen about this. And I'm finding these things.
Yeah, I got in an old In Search Of episode, you know, they would start it off where they had done a couple of movies before they did the whole series with Leonard Nimoy hosting that. and looking into mysterious things, and they had done some, where they had brought on this scientist, and he was a Nobel winning scientist, and his theory was exactly that it shows a complete break, that evolution doesn't make sense for humans. It does for the rest of the animals on the planet, but humans in particular don't share the same kind of history with the animals. We do have a caller on the line, so I want to get to this caller real quick, and then I'll get back into that idea. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you
hear
me?
Okay, great. Yeah, did you have a question? We sure can.
Oh, I don't have a question. I just have a comment. I'm just trembling. I've been trembling for 10 minutes now after I heard Franklin talk about the auditorium where he was taken.
Uh-huh.
And my name is Kim Carlsberg, and I wrote a book in the mid-90s about my experiences called Beyond My Wildest Dreams. And I actually have a chapter in the book called Complexities, which describes the exact same place. And
wow.
I was told I was being prepared for something in this auditorium, and I was very belligerent, and I was removed from the auditorium, but I hadn't heard about that before, and I just wanted to comment on that. And these things just, these confirmations pop up every once in a while, and I just needed to share that with you guys.
Well, I appreciate you sharing it, because I had not had confirmation of it, and that's wonderful to know that somebody else has seen an auditorium as well as myself.
That's great. So did you write a book?
No, I have not.
Oh, I heard you referring to a book. So, well, I've been out of the UFO world for quite some time. After I wrote the book, I kind of closed that chapter of my life. But now with the Internet, cruising around the Internet, you can't help but get sucked back in with all this wonderful information, you know, so readily available these days. I wanted to thank you. This has been a fascinating, first time I've heard this blog talk radio, and completely fascinating, and thank you for your courage. And who knows, maybe we'll see each other in an auditorium somewhere.
Yeah. Well, we're having a conference in September in Denver, and I don't know where you are, but in Denver we're having the Institute for the Study of Galactic Civilizations having their first conference, and it'll be a great place to learn more about the history of this contact. This contact's been going on for, according to some, a million years, and some, you know, 400,000 years ago, and there's a lot of documented evidence that this might have taken place, as they say, even 400,000 years ago. And then the 250,000, there's some other. There were as many as 12 or 15 different races visiting the Earth at different times, and so that's how the timeline gets kind of out of whack. Some of them came here early and left, and some came later and stayed, and so as they dig in and get more and more information that they can document, it's really getting to be fascinating as to what this is all about. And
It is certainly fascinating.
What was the name of your book?
My book? I think you can probably still catch it on, you know, used bookstores or Amazon or something like that. But it's called Beyond My Wildest Dreams.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when did you write that, Kim?
I wrote that in 95. And at that time, you know, I believe I was the first woman to talk about the female experience, you know, blatantly about the implantations and so forth. So I got a lot of requests for, you know, television shows and talk shows, and I did that for a while. And once I came to understand everything thoroughly enough, like I said, I was able to put it behind me, but it's still out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a part of your life experience. I mean, you can't get away from it having happened, and that's just, you've integrated it and went on with your life, which is what I've done. I went on and finished my business career and stayed in highly sensitive areas. I worked in handle the finances of some companies, and I handled a lot of work with the FDA that was highly, you had to have extreme credibility, and so I managed to integrate it into my life and went on and did that kind of work without ever saying anything to anybody.
Well, you know, it's funny, in my business, so many times they kept repeating these television shows over and over throughout the years, you know, for decades, 15 years, and I would be in a new business arena, and someone would come up to me the next day and say, well, I saw you on television last night. And, you know, and then my cover was blown. So it's tricky to kind of deal with all of it at once. But I don't want to take up any more of your time because you're so fascinating. It would be wonderful if – do you have a contact information website or emails or –
If you would, I'll give you my personal email. I give it out all over the country. It's an acronym. It's S, as in Sam, F-R-F-C. That's S-F-R-F-C.
F-C.
Sam,
mm-hmm.
Frank Robert, Frank Charlie, at FRII.com.
F-R-I.
And I'd be happy to get FRII.
Got it.
Okay.
Well, maybe we'll chat a little further in the future.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Kim. And we do have the website we're talking about, too, if you were to email him there through that, galacticcivilizations.org, we'd be able to get that to you, too. So, and we're going to talk a lot more about that now. So that's another great thing about the Internet. A lot of these people getting stories out and being able to talk and finding connections like these, because
like
actually
these.
This is like the you're not the first story I've heard of an auditorium type of training scenario.
Well, that's interesting, and you and I have never talked about that, but we'll have to talk about that one day.
Yeah,
I don't know
so
why
I've
they
heard
didn't
of,
tell me any more about it, and they didn't let me sit down and listen. Just, I guess
yeah,
I,
do you I remember can't... a belligerent lady that got kicked out?
I don't believe she was there. Maybe they'd already kicked her out because they were all sitting very quiet when I was in there.
Everybody was well behaved. So,
let's talk about the
Institute for Study of Galactic Civilizations and
conference
that's coming up.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss it because it's something that's really dear to my heart now because we're beyond, if they're here, which, like I say, I know they're here. So if they're here, we need to learn more about them and then how long have they been coming here. And that's what got me into this searching into the history of this connection. And I found a very interesting connection prior to our Aristotle. Now, this is really weird, but prior to Aristotle in 384 B.C. is when he was born. But prior to that, the view of the universe was that there were many worlds and many civilizations and many gods. And he came along and says, no, there's only one civilization, there's only one God, and there's only the Earth is the center of that universe. And for almost 1,500 years, that became the way to go. And there was an Italian philosopher in 1571 that proposed once again that no, we're not the center of the universe. The sun is the center of our solar system, and there are many universes and many other civilizations. And for his wisdom, he got burned at the stake. So it's been serious business all through the history of mankind about this stuff. And the Institute for the Study of these Civilizations, I think, is a very important thing because it gives particularly the scientific people, a platform to come and talk about this under conditions that are more of the academic type where they feel comfortable, whereas if you go to a, quote, UFO conference, they're not going there. They just don't. If they do, they're not going to say anything. And we're hoping that with the Institute that they will be able to come and contribute. And, of course, we're happy to have our conference. Author David Horn is a Ph.D. that was trained at Yale University in anthropology, they call it, and some paleontology, and he studied the apes for two or three years and wrote a number of papers and articles and taught at Colorado State University for 8 or 10 years, taught anthropology and paleontology, and in his travels he met a lady in California, and she was very spiritual, and he was not. But she got him to go into some of her spiritual contacts, and all of a sudden he had some kind of an epiphany. I haven't talked with him yet. I'm going to interview him for our website, hopefully here in the next couple of months, find out just what happened. But he changed, came back to the university, and resigned. He says, I cannot teach Darwin's theory of evolution anymore because it's not the truth. He says, there is not, it just doesn't fit. And he resigned and went out on and wrote a book. And that book details, it's probably one of the best two or three books that are there. About three or four really good books about this history, and his book's called Humanity's Extraterrestrial Origins, and he documents through the literature all of this stuff of the paleontology and the archaeology and all of the other clues that are out there. And we had no trouble getting him to agree to come to this, and he's not on the speaker circuit, at least. I can't find where he's given a talk anywhere. We don't know what kind of speaker he's going to be because we've never heard him. But since he was a university professor, we figure he can talk probably pretty good.
And that's pretty exciting. I hadn't, you know, heard of him, and I'm really excited to hear what he has to say.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we'll have Dr. Leo Sprinkle.
Yes. And he's hopefully is going to – he's never talked much about his experience with – his clients, and that's what we've asked him to dig into, and what he's learned from over 600 people that he's regressed individually and worked with. And of course, he's worked with thousands. He's probably the most unsung hero to people in the UFO community that there is. He is the guy that's done more to help. He took the contact ease when nobody would touch him. He took them, and he ran psychological tests on them and proved that they were sound of mind and that they had just had an extraordinary experience. They weren't hoaxers. They weren't trying to make money off of it, and they weren't crazy. And he became a beacon for people that had contact experience. And, of course, having been to him and been helped by him, I just think he's one of the greatest guys in the business, and he's got tremendous knowledge in this field. I mean, he is a very studious man, and he's a very attentive to details, and he has a tremendous memory. So I'm just really looking forward to hearing him talk about this in September. He's going to be a great speaker, and I think we'll learn a lot, and it's a good place for him to come out. He had a hard time. He was at the University of Wyoming, and of course, he got to be professor, but he never got to be considered for department head or anything because they didn't like his UFO connections. And he just says, well, this is part of my life, and I'm going to continue to do it, and you're going to have to fire me. And, of course, they did try to fire John Mack, who was a psychiatrist at Harvard, because of his experiences of getting involved with the abductees and contactees. So it's still a kind of a rough world out there, and hopefully the Institute will give us a place where people can come and feel safe and tell the stories and the science. You know, if we can put this science together, it takes it out of the realm of, well, it was a folk story or it was a mythology or something like that. And when you see the science behind it and credible people that are real credible scientists saying, this is what I know now and I'm willing to talk about, this is a great thing.
I think it's great, too. We have another PhD, Dr. Norma Milanovic. I don't know much about her, and it's kind of neat to also have – we'll have Rainbow Eagle, a Choctaw, a Native American teacher, and he puts a lot of different cultures, Native American cultures and their concepts into play with all of this stuff, too, and that mixture I love.
Yeah, it's a great mixture because the Native Americans have, and indigenous people all over the world, just make no bones about it, that they were visited. In fact, their history was that they came from the stars, and that the star people were the people that brought them here. And it's really going to be great, I'm telling you. And Dr. Milanovic, I've I've heard her speak. She's an excellent speaker, and of course I've read her books, and my wife went to one of her workshops, and she's really good, and so we're lucky there. And of course, Wendell Stevens, he's the dean of all this. Wendell's been at it longer than anybody. I mean, well, I guess Leo's been at it about as long, but Wendell has been collecting photographs since 1961 or 62 and has about 3,500 documented. And, of course, if you know, I bought some of the photos of that I use in my talks from Wendell, and every photo that he sells, he gives the history of the photo, who took it, where they took it, and what it depicts. And I thought that was amazing, as many photos as he's got. But he's got the history that comes with them. And, I mean, that takes a lot of time to do that. You buy 10 photos.
And he was in the Navy?
He was in the Air Force.
In the Navy, he was Air Force, right.
Yeah,
he was also an attorney and a judge.
Yeah, he's a lieutenant colonel, retired in the Air Force, and he was in charge of a bomber squadron, and they sent him to Alaska. They took his bomber squadron and outfitted it with cameras instead of guns, and they sent him to Alaska to photograph UFOs. And this was in the early 60s, and he photographed a whole bunch of them, and he said that when they came down, they took the camera and the film, and he never saw one of them. And his first photograph that he collected is one showed up in an envelope one day and says, I thought you'd like to see what you photographed. And he says he doesn't know who gave it to him or where it come from. And that's got him interested, and he began to find out that other people had photographs, and that's got him into the collecting of the photographs. And
we're almost out of time, but we'll have Sheldon Neidel there, and also Stan Romanek. I've talked a lot about his case. So if you want to hear firsthand about his case, you know, you can come to this conference and do that. And so when is his conference? Where can they get info?
July 25th, 26th, and 27th at the University, Denver University. Yeah, in September. September 25th, 6th, and 7th. Yeah.
And like I said before, you can go to galacticcivilizations.org to hear more about this. And we need more funds, right?
Yes, we do. Anybody that can, we have a fundraiser going on to raise money for the Institute. We want to do some investigation and try to fund some of these researchers to dig into a lot more of these anomalies. And it takes money. And so we've set up a kind of a special fund that if you donate $500 to the Institute, we will give you a free conference admission for the whole conference. It's it's $200 at the door in September. It's $125 if you register before July the 1st, and it's going to be $175 from July 1st to August 1st, and then it's going to be $175 from there to September the 23rd, and then goes to $200. And we'll give you a full conference registration where it'll entitle you to everything at the conference for a $500 donation. And, of course, if you have a family and want to donate several of those, you can get, you know, the whole family can get in free. So we'd appreciate anything.
Yeah.
And if you don't have $500 and you got $5, there'll be a place on the website to go and to just send a check, and or you can, I believe we
can. Well, and you can go down there and push the PayPal button. We're out of time, so I got to rush you off. But
thank you
on the show, Franklin.
We enjoyed it very much. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling,
great,
Tim.
Right. All right, bye-bye.
And we'll be talking to you soon. And I'll have very soon posted our speaker for next week, because I will have a show next weekend in mind. And it'll be another great show. But thanks to Franklin. It's always wonderful to talk to him. Maybe we'll have him back to talk more about some other of his concepts. He had some great talks. But check out galacticcivilizations.org. Remember, galacticcivilizations.org for more about the Institute for the Study of Galactic Civilizations. Thank you, everybody, for joining, and you all have a wonderful remainder of your weekend and a great week, and we'll be talking to you soon.